Indomedia Global Report on Resonance FM 104.4. Check out www.indomedia.org.uk.
In a democracy, the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, the general population, have to be kept from interfering. They can be spectators, but not participants.
No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do.
Spectators, but not participants.
All before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome.
It's time to talk about censorship.
Welcome to this week's Indie Media Global Reports. Coming up on the show today, we have This Week in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Centre as ever. We're going to be speaking to people in Cambridge about their anti-GM campaign and how, for once, the activist movement has had a victory. I shouldn't say that, that's a bit cynical, but there has been a victory of sorts in GM campaigning. We also have reports from Gaza, from our female correspondent in Gaza, and we have stuff from the Peace Camp in Trafalgar Square. Right now, we're going to go to This Week in Palestine.
This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for June 16th through the 22nd, 2007. Hamas and Fatah trade accusations as the Palestinian president accuses Hamas of attempting to assassinate him. Meanwhile, Israel continues to close the Gaza border crossings as Abbas and Omar prepare to meet. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with the nonviolent actions in Palestine against the wall and settlements. Around 50 residents of the village of Salamona, located to the south of Bethlehem in the West Bank, joined by international and Israeli peace activists, marched on Friday against confiscation of land by Israel for the purposes of the construction of the illegal wall. This week, the aim of the demonstration was to plant a number of olive trees on the land planned for confiscation. As is the case each week, protesters were pushed, kicked, and assaulted by the Israeli military, who prevented them from planting any trees on the land. Sami Awad, the director of the Holy Land Trust organization and one of the protesters at Salamona today, stated,
"The response of the Israeli army was very violent and very brutal, where they came and even attacked us before we even reached close to where that property is and prevented us from going there. So even planting 20 trees, 20 olive trees, for the sake of peace, for the sake of justice, was denied by the Israeli soldiers."
A short scuffle took place between Israeli forces and demonstrators, leading to the arrest of two Israeli activists. Medical sources in Bethlehem reported no injuries at the demonstration. As is the case each week, the people of Beilin, located near the central West Bank city of Ramallah, joined by international and Israeli peace activists, conducted their weekly protest against the construction of the illegal wall that will cut the village from its rightfully owned land. The Israeli army blocked the road leading to the gate of the wall, and as soon as the protesters arrived at the barricade, they were fired upon with rubber-coated steel bullets, tear gas, and sound bombs, leading to the injury of five people, among them two internationals. Also, during the protests, two members of the Popular Committee Against Construction of the Wall and Settlements were kidnapped by Israeli forces. While one was later released, the other was moved to a nearby detention camp. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert are scheduled to hold a meeting in the Sharm el-Sheikh resort in the Sinai Desert in Egypt on Sunday under Egyptian-Jordanian auspices. Egyptian officials say that Monday's summit will boost Abbas and isolate Hamas. The summit comes shortly after Hamas took control over the Gaza Strip after fierce fights with the Palestinian National Security Forces and the Al-Aqsa Brigades, Fatah's armed wing, which lasted for 5 days, leaving at least 180 dead and as many as 600 injured. Following the Gaza incidents, Abbas decided to dismiss the National Unity Government, declared a state of emergency, and formed an interim government to implement emergency rules. Immediately after Abbas's declaration, the United States and the European Union declared that they would resume direct aid to the new Palestinian government formed by the Minister of Finance in the former Unity government, Dr. Salam Fayyad. Many other world and Arab leaders expressed satisfaction with Abbas's decision. Israel, for its part, said it would release the money it has been holding since March of 2006, which, according to the Oslo Accords, is due to the Palestinian Authority. However, the conflict between Fatah and Hamas has escalated, and both traded accusations and insults through the media, especially following Abbas's speech to the Central Council of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO. In his speech, Abbas ruled out talks with Hamas and accused the Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, of attempting to assassinate him and of carrying out a coup in the Gaza Strip against the Palestinian Authority. Abbas, for the first time, publicly described Hamas as a murderous terrorist movement. In response, Hamas called his remarks disgusting, describing Abbas and several other Fatah leaders as slaves to the Zionists. Meanwhile, thousands of Hamas supporters took to the streets of Gaza on Thursday denouncing Abbas, and Dr. Khalil Abu Lila, Hamas leader in Gaza, rejected Abbas's accusations.
This is a totally false accusation. If the Qassam brigades of Hamas activists wanted to assassinate Abbas, they could have easily done it.
Meanwhile, Israel cut fuel supplies to the Gaza Strip and threatened to cut electricity and water supplies by closing all the entrances to the Strip. Such a move would create a humanitarian crisis in the region. The United Nations issued a report on Wednesday stating that unless Israel allows basic supplies to enter the Gaza Strip, the coastal region would run out of those supplies in less than 1 month. Late on Wednesday night, the Israeli army evacuated to Egypt dozens of Palestinian Gaza residents who had spent days at the Eretz border crossing in the northern Gaza Strip. Several Palestinians, mainly Fatah loyalists, fled the Gaza Strip after Hamas assumed control there. A Palestinian man waiting to flee the Gaza Strip was killed and several were wounded when Israeli troops stationed on the border shot at them on Monday. Thousands of Palestinians remain stranded between Egypt and Gaza on the Rafah crossing, awaiting permission to enter Gaza. Of these people, most were in Egypt for medical treatment. During the week, the Egyptian border police attempted to force them to return to Egypt. Mohammed Al-Lubas, one of the Palestinians stuck at the border, stated,
"We are roughly 3,000 people stuck here, men, women, elderly, and children. We have no more money to stay. We desperately need to go back to Gaza. We have been here at the terminal for 51 days. There's no food or medicine. I'm sick. I was in Egypt for treatment, and when I came back, the terminal was closed. Egyptian police forcefully transported many of us back to Cairo, but the rest are hiding in the nearby farms."
The Gaza Strip now experiencing a period of relative calm under Hamas's control. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority continues to partially control parts of the West Bank. Israel, however, has not ruled out an invasion of the coastal region. An invasion that would be designed to search for and eliminate those Palestinian resistance fighters who, despite the internal conflict in Gaza, continued to fire homemade shells at Israel. During the week, the Israeli army conducted at least 32 military invasions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank. IMEMC's Ghassan Benoura has more.
During invasions this week, Israeli troops killed two Palestinian resistance fighters and kidnapped 50 Palestinian civilians. Thus, the number of Palestinians kidnapped by the Israeli army in the West Bank since the beginning of this year has mounted to 1,408. Israeli soldiers shot and killed on Wednesday two Palestinian resistance fighters in Kfar Dan village, west of the northern West Bank city of Jenin. The two fighters exchanged fire with the invading forces for more than 1 hour before they were killed. Eyewitnesses reported that undercover units of the Israeli army infiltrated the village using three Palestinian vehicles and occupied several houses after holding the residents hostage. The forces then occupied the rooftops of the attacked houses and posted their sharpshooters there. Later, ordinary units invaded the village from several directions and surrounded a neighborhood where the fighters were located. The two exchanged fire with the invading forces for more than 1 hour, but the soldiers used grenades and military helicopter fired at least two missiles at the fighters. Medical sources reported that the two fighters bled to death after being hit by several rounds of live ammunition and missile fragments. The High Court of Justice rejected a petition by human rights organization Adala against the military advocate general on Tuesday. The petition from the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel called for an investigation into the death of a Palestinian who was killed during Israeli army attack in the West Bank city of Hebron 3 years ago. This was a tragic incident in which the deceased was killed. This was a result of a chain of events and circumstances that led to the deceased being suspected of involvement in hostile activity, the judge said. For IMEMC.org, this is Ghassan Bannoura.
In the Gaza Strip, the Israeli army conducted 2 invasions into local communities, killing 5 Palestinians and injuring at least 10 others. IMEMC's John Smith has more.
4 Palestinians were killed and at least another 4 injured as the Israeli army invaded Al-Karara village, located near Khan Yunis city in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, on Wednesday morning. Palestinian sources said all 4 were resistance fighters who tried to prevent the invasion. Witnesses reported that Israeli tanks and bulldozers stormed the area in the early morning, opening fire at various homes. Witnesses added that a number of Israeli troops also occupied homes and used them as shooting posts. The Israeli army announced that 1 soldier sustained moderate wounds during the clashes. During the week, the Israeli army continued to impose a strict siege on the Gaza Strip. The Rafah International Crossing Point has been closed since late June 2006, despite the fact that the Israeli army does not directly control it. This week, following the rise of Hamas to power in the coastal region, the crossing was completely closed, leaving thousands of Palestinians stranded at the borders. All commercial and border crossings leading in and out of the Gaza Strip have been closed for the past week. A Palestinian man hoping to flee Gaza was killed and several others wounded when Israeli troops stationed on the northern Gaza-Israeli border shot at them on Monday. In other news, the United Nations issued a report on Wednesday stating that unless Israel allows basic supplies to enter the Gaza Strip, the coastal region will run out of these supplies in approximately 2 to 4 weeks. For IMEMC.org, this is John Smith.
And that's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, check out our website, www.imemc.org. Thanks for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This is Beth Thompson.
And now we're going to be speaking with a spokesperson from Cambridge about the anti-genetic modified freaky vegetables campaign. Hello, are you there, spokesperson from Cambridge?
I am indeed. Hello.
Hello. I understand that there's been a bit of a victory for GM campaigners. Could you tell us a little bit about why there has been a victory?
I certainly can. So there's been plans afoot to have 2 GM test sites running in the UK this year, and that's the first time that there's been GM tests happening in the UK for a number of years. A campaign was launched as soon as people heard this was going to happen, and one of the 2 sites was due to be in a place called Heddon near Hull, and the victory that you speak of is basically a result of a local campaign up in Hull. The company concerned, BSF, have decided, despite getting permission from DEFRA to go ahead with their trial over the next 5 years, they've decided not to go ahead with planting GM potatoes this year after the strength of the local response from campaigners. They've cited particularly opposition from local borage farmers who are concerned about the impact that GM cross-contamination might have on their crops. We're glad to say that the campaign in Heddon has been very successful so far.
What kind of campaigning tools did they use to create this?
Okay, so there was a variety of events and actions. There was a local public meeting which was very successful in terms of bringing together local campaigners with local farmers, and I think they also managed to get the representative of BASF to go along to that meeting. He got a pretty hard time, by all accounts.
What's BASF?
BASF is the company, it's a German multinational chemical company, basically, and they are the company who are licensed to carry out these trials.
Do they carry out trials in Germany?
That's a good question. They've certainly tried to carry out trials in other European countries. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head whether they've successfully done so in Germany recently, but this exact same GM potato trial was originally, they tried to carry it out in Ireland in what might be seen as a cynical move, given that the point of this GM potato trial allegedly is to combat late blight in potatoes. The Irish Environmental Protection Agency eventually gave them permission to carry out the trials, despite a really strong local campaign, but they imposed very strict conditions and regulations about what BASF would have to do if they carried the trial out in Ireland. For example, they stipulated that BASF would have to be responsible for and pay for monitoring of cross-contamination in the area for several years after the trial had taken place. Now, BASF decided that they couldn't really be bothered to undergo, you know, to carry out the trial under these kind of strict conditions. So they went elsewhere. They also went to the Netherlands, where the trial was actually stopped in its tracks when it had just started by a Dutch judge, because basically BASF had failed to follow correct procedures in terms of informing the authorities about environmental concerns and so on. So we've basically had this trial effectively stopped in Ireland by the Environmental Protection Agency there, stopped by a senior judge in the Netherlands. But DEFRA, clearly being much more business-friendly, you know, New Labour being business-friendly, are very happy for BASF to come here and carry out the trial in much laxer conditions.
So what else did the local people of Hull do to prevent their potatoes getting cross-contaminated?
Okay, so aside from the public meeting, there was also a national demonstration called for, where there were various speakers and also, perhaps more significantly, campaigners went to the trial site itself, and spontaneously people ran into what they thought at the time was the appropriate field where the GM trial site was going to be, and planted organic potatoes. I think partly as a kind of agitprop to just draw attention to the event, but also to show the authorities and the company concerned that people were going to be prepared to take direct action in any way that they could to resist these GM trials from taking place. And I think that sent a strong message to BASF and indeed the local farmer whose land was going to be used, that they were probably going to face serious public disquiet and certainly people willing to engage in direct action to put a stop to the trials.
So they've put a stop to the trials, but there's going to be a protest in Cambridge this week. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
That's correct. So unfortunately, BASF have actually planted their GM potatoes at the site near Cambridge, which that makes that, you know, now the only place in the UK where GM crops are being grown. And a lot of people are seeing this as a test bed, really, to see whether there's going to be a strong public reaction against GM. And if there isn't, you know, there's a green light to go ahead with more and more trials. So, yeah, a protest, a potato picnic protest has been called for 12 noon this Sunday, July the 1st, starting at Girton Parish Church in Girton near Cambridge, where basically people are being encouraged to come along and show their solidarity with people who are campaigning against GM potatoes and show that they're not happy with this trial happening and not happy to let this be a green light for further trials to happen all around the UK.
So what is this particular genetic modification? Have they put the genes of rabbits or fish or something inside the potatoes?
They haven't. Now, I'm not a scientist, so I won't claim to go into any kind of in-depth scientific detail, but BASF claim that it's a very safe kind of genetic engineering because they are using a gene from a close relative or something from the potato family in terms of this genetic experiment. But there have been examples previously, which I'm afraid I can't quote off the top of my head, but there have been examples of the insertion of genes from very similar varieties into other varieties where there have been unexpected results. And obviously the whole concern that a lot of people in the scientific community have about GM is about the unpredictability. It's about the fact that we just don't know what's going to happen when you take one gene and insert it in this completely unnatural way into a completely different plant. We don't know what effect it's going to have on the plants themselves as they grow, and more worryingly, we don't know what effect it's going to have on the wider environment and what kind of cross-contamination could potentially take place.
So what is the point of these trials? Is it like the stuff with Roundup Ready that happened last year so they could change the herbicide cycle, or is it some other kind of glorious scheme they have in mind?
Okay, so what they claim, they're not actually claiming to be trying to feed the world on this occasion, which is nice, so we don't have to debunk that ridiculous argument. What they are claiming is that basically the potato growing industry is spending £50 million a year combating blight, and so would benefit from developing these blight-resistant potatoes. Now, that's interesting because while BASF are claiming that this is costing British potato growers £50 million a year, the British Potato Council are actually coming out and saying, no, actually, it maybe costs them £3 million a year, but certainly not 50. And, in fact, the British Potato Council is also saying that they're completely opposed to these GM trials happening because they understand that people don't want to eat GM food, and they don't want potatoes being linked in people's minds with GM. So you've got the general public saying they don't want it. You've got the British Potato Council opposed to it, the potato producers and processors saying they don't want it. It's very hard to see who wants this trial to go ahead apart from BASF, who hope that they can make some money from it.
Surely these trials are costing more than £3 million.
Absolutely. I mean, BASF are investing millions in their GM research, and yeah, clearly, I'm sure there's lots of things they could do with the money that would be much more useful than this ridiculous research, which, you know, is not only unwanted by all these different people, but it's also very difficult to say how useful it would be, even if they could produce a GM potato that was resistant to blight. Blight is a thing that is a fungus that changes and mutates regularly in the natural environment. So even if you could produce a GM potato that was blight resistant, there's nothing to say that in 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years' time the blight wouldn't have changed in such a way that it would that this variety of potatoes would no longer be resistant to it.
So I suppose, in a way, it's very cynical to try and get popular support for blight in Ireland.
Indeed.
And but the problem with Ireland wasn't the fact that there were lack of potatoes. It was to do with the British government at the time not feeding people.
Absolutely. And that's obviously, very much the same with many of the GM arguments that go on today when the GM biotech companies are talking about, GM being a technology that can feed the world. It's quite obvious that we have enough food to go around. That's not the problem. It's the distribution and the economic system rather than the agricultural technology that is causing problems in that area.
Well, I guess the Terminator gene is causing major problems in India.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, these trials we're talking about now aren't using Terminator genes themselves, but I think, yeah, the fact that these companies have developed technologies like that show very clearly how cynical they are and how driven they are by profits rather than by in any way improving the lives of people who are going to be growing or potentially eating these products.
I wonder, could you remind our listeners one more time about the date and times of the protest in Cambridge, in case anyone might like to go and put their wellies on and stamp through a muddy field?
Absolutely. So it's going to be this Sunday, which is July 1st, at 12 noon, meeting at Girton. Now, there's excellent directions on the internet at the Mutato site. That's www.mutatoes.org. There's great directions there and with bus times and so on. So if people want to check that out and come along, they would be very, very welcome indeed.
Thank you very much and good luck. And I hope that no injunctions are winging their way towards this campaign. Now we're going to hear from the Peace Camp with Roy Bard, our intrepid bearded reporter, has been out on Saturday.
Last night I had the strangest dream I've ever dreamt before. I dreamt that all the world agreed to put an end to war. I dreamt I saw a mighty room, and the room was filled with men. And the paper they were signing said they'd never fight again. And when the paper was all signed and a million copies made, they all joined hands and bowed their heads, and thankful prayers were made. And the people in the street below were dancing round and round, whilst guns and swords and uniforms lay scattered on the ground. Last night I had the strangest dream I've ever dreamt before. I dreamt that all the world agreed to put an end to war.
Brian Hall singing on the PA at Parliament Square on Saturday afternoon. The PA was part of the global peace strike. At the same time that was going on, a peace camp was being set up, and I spoke to one of the campers.
My name is Susan Clarkson, and I live in Oxford. And I've come here today, at lunchtime today, to join the peace camp on Parliament Square, the unauthorised peace camp. We've called together this camp to mark the leaving of office of Tony Blair and the coming into office of Gordon Brown. But our point is that whether it's Blair or Brown, war is still the issue. That the same policies are in place whether it's Blair or Brown in number 10. And so for this we're using this a symbol of Tweedledum and Tweedledee. We're talking about Tweedle Blair and Tweedle Brown, and lots of us are wearing t-shirts with that image on. And really what we're hoping to highlight in this camp is to ask for all the troops to be brought back from Iraq and Afghanistan, to scrap the Trident missile system, and to commit to not to support the United States in any attack on Iran. And we're also here in support of Brian Hall, whose camp is an authorised one, and we support and appreciate everything that he's done over the past 6.5 years that he's been here, highlighting the fact that our government is ordering the killing of children and innocent people. What's going to happen is we've got various events. We've got a workshop on climate change. We have a workshop on nuclear weapons and what's happening at Aldermaston. We've got music, poetry, dancing.
It's an unauthorised protest. How have the police reacted so far?
They haven't put in an appearance so far. I believe they're around outside the around the square, but we haven't seen them and they haven't approached us.
Okay, and the camp's going to be here until Thursday at 12 o'clock, I believe. People are welcome to drop down, are they?
Absolutely, yes. People are welcome to drop in and join us for whatever event is happening, or just to hang out and chat and enjoy the nice rain.
Okay, it's just started raining now. Is there a website that people can go to if they need more information?
Yes, the website is www.warisstilltheissue.org.
That's great. Thanks a lot, Susan. Video and reports of the peace camp can also be found, as usual, on our newswire, which is at www.indymedia.org.uk. This is FTP for Indie Media Global Report on Resonance 104.4 FM.
And that was Free the Peeps there, Mr. FTP. And now in the studio, I'm very privileged to have with me, of course, we've got Zoe, Madam of the Announcements, planner of the diary for activists around London. And she's with a documentary filmmaker that's originally all the way from India called Kazu, who has been in a place that I mustn't say it's Kazakhstan because I'm sure it's Kyrgyzstan, who's been in Kyrgyzstan, I think. And they're going to have a chat about what are the issues with Kyrgyzstan?
Okay, so this is Kazu Ahmed, who I know from India.
And he's not only a documentary maker, he also works in community radio and as a journalist, and he's mainly working with Panos South Asia. Is that right? Can you tell me what Panos South Asia is doing in Central Asia?
Well, Panos South Asia actually works on communicating research, and this particular project we're doing a film on migration now. We're filming the migrants who come from southern Kyrgyzstan up to the towns of Bishkek and Almaty to work in the markets. This is actually, again, a part of Panos South Asia's communicating research program. We're working with the Swiss National Center for Competence and Research, the University of Zurich, in making this documentary. We're going to have it it's both for the media and the research communities to work, to use this resource of research that comes out of research.
So this is the sort of thing that Panos does. It's sort of communicating research for journalists, media in the countries of the south. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Yeah. And so, what are the issues that you found when you were in Kyrgyzstan? What's driving people off the land and to the cities?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, after the Soviet Union collapsed, you had nations that were you had nationalities that were. That were left completely, they didn't know what to do after this whole structure broke down. And very swiftly, the market economy came in. And people, I don't think people are geared enough to handle this market economy. So what had happened, very interestingly, there's a small village in southern Kyrgyzstan that I had gone to. And this village was a farming collective during the Soviet era. And there were a lot of people who were settled there. A lot of people came by themselves as well. But a lot of people who were settled there to do farming as a collective. But after the Soviet Union, this whole collective sort of collapsed, and people started migrating to various places such as Bishkek, like I said again, Almaty, and also to Moscow. I think about a lot of people who we had spoken with in the village. They say that about 80% of the households have someone or the other in any of these cities, Bishkek, Almaty or Moscow, trading in the various markets where you find a lot of goods coming in from China and Thailand and many other places.
So this is one part of this whole system of globalization, of goods moving around the world, people moving around the world. Are these people finding free movement, or is there problems with moving between parts of the former Soviet Union?
That's one of the issues. I mean, when you talk about the former Soviet Union and people who served in the military, for example, they're engineers and people from all walks of life who used to serve the former Soviet Union. They are finding themselves as traders now. And they keep saying that, well, we used to go and visit Kiev and Moscow and visit our friends there without any borders. Earlier on, but now they are finding it difficult to move around, and they're losing in touch with all the people all around the former Soviet Union. That's one, but more importantly, I think the government really doesn't know what to do in this regard. There are policies where you have to, if a trader in Kyrgyzstan goes to Kazakhstan to trade, he or she has to get a trading license, but it's difficult to get a trading license, and so people actually become illegal that way, in those terms. That's one of the things. The second thing is, I heard, I'm not entirely sure about this, if there is a policy being made on that, that they're going to now have strict regulations for the borders, for the border posts. And if that happens, then a lot of the people who move from one place to another to trade, they are going to face a lot of difficulty. For example, I know for a fact that there are a lot of people who are trading in the markets of Almaty. These are huge, huge markets where you find all sorts of goods. And these are sort of the alternative space, if you like, to the huge supermarkets that you have. These are small stalls run by people who migrate, living in the outskirts of town. So people from Almaty, people trading in Almaty, come to Bishkek to buy goods and take to Almaty and to trade there. And people probably take it to Moscow as well. I'm not entirely sure, but I presume they'd probably try and do that as well. So if the border regime is made stronger, made more strict, I think the traders are going to suffer, and a lot of people probably won't have the avenues to trade at all in Almaty, and they might have to come back to the villages to whatever they've got.
Because I was reading that in Moscow lately there was a clampdown on a lot of the markets, that traders who were not formally Russian, like as in the new borders of Russia, were all banned from trading, and the markets became empty sort of overnight.
Of course there is. I mean, there is clampdown on traders every other day. I mean, the traders know this, the police know that, you know, everybody knows that. And the very interesting thing that I came across when I was filming was that in the markets of Bishkek, it was very relaxed. I could film people, they could talk about things. The moment I'm in Almaty, you know, they are very... You can feel the tense air. I mean, it's tension all around. People are not as relaxed as in Bishkek. It's because, you know, I presume it is because of the because of the status of these people, of the traders, as illegal or whatever you call them. And I was told that in Moscow, the situation is even more tense. You cannot go into the market and speak with people there because they're really afraid to talk about things. You know, and of course, you know, people, you talk to any trader from Kyrgyzstan who's gone to Kazakhstan, for example, they'll tell you about how the harassments and how the forces, police, and other people come and talk. The police actually comes and checks them and probably throws them out sometimes and really have a lot of
harassment. I was just wondering, did you have any problems as a journalist working? Because it's quite difficult for journalists to work in Moscow, certainly. Did you find that in other Soviet countries?
Not really. I didn't go there as a journalist. It was a research kind of thing. So there are, the media is there. It's quite strong. In terms of talking about political issues, but it's not really quite. It's not quite there. I mean, you know, they're still very. It's interest oriented, I must say. You know, it's strong in a very interest-oriented way, that whoever owns the paper probably would talk about it. I mean, I found that the issues of migration, environment, or pollution... I mean, Almaty is a very polluted town, but people have told me that, you know, things really do not come out in the media. So there is a lot of information about day-to-day public life and post-socialist Central Asia, you know, that doesn't really come out in the newspapers or the media. But corruption is one thing they've been talking about, and it's very donor driven now. You know, Kyrgyzstan is donor driven, definitely. So you hear the language of the donors. For example, you talk about governance and corruption and all these things that's usually spoken by the donors. Nobody speaks about migration or the new economic polity or anything like that. So
talking about migration, back closer to where you're from in Assam, northeast India, when I visited there, I remember people talking about the Bangladeshi immigrants. And can you tell me, lately I've heard that there's been a fence being built?
Well, yes, I mean, the Bangladeshi, the immigration of people from Bangladesh has been a huge issue, and more so politically in Assam and in other parts of, the northeastern region of India. And, yes, it has been made a... You know, apart from the fact that it's been made a huge political issue and nobody is actually going in to do absolutely concrete research, there is no tool or technique in place to really figure out who is a Indian national and who is not. And yes, the government of India has actually started building a fence all along the border of Bangladesh, the India-Bangladesh border. It is in the states of Meghalaya, Assam and Tripura. And I think quite a stretch of it has been built now. And I visited Tripura recently, and I went along the border. It's quite funny because you have a small pillar, concrete pillar, which is about 2 feet in height, in place, which is apparently the actual. I mean, there are all the pillars all along the way, which is apparently this. It's the actual line of control, and then 150 meters towards the Indian side, quote unquote, they will have a fence. So, and the Indian sort of security people, the border security people, told me that we have literally given 150 yards of our sort of land, you know, to have this little border sort of space. But there are actually people living in those borders, in between that pillar and the fence, and they do not want to come up to the quote unquote Indian side, because they have their relatives in Bangladesh, and they find it easier to go past that small pillar than, you know, past the fence. And the people across the border, the so-called border, people speak the same language, they look the same, they do the same things, they trade and they're agriculturalists, and even the security personnel do not know how to distinguish them. I mean, you know, but there is definitely a very an air of sort of, you know, fear that has been brought around, that is brought on by the fence. And one of the security personnel actually told me that, well, people didn't know borders earlier, but now with the fence we are succeeding. So you can actually see that the notion of border has been completely concretized by this structure, this you know,
so
steel structure.
It's really going to limit how poor people move around, because if you're wealthier, you can probably afford a passport. But if you're really poor and you're either side of the border and you're used to visiting your family, you're not going to be able to afford a passport. And so it's a way of stopping people moving. But is it very subject to corruption?
Well, of course it is. I mean, you do find reports in newspapers every day talking about how the security forces, they sort of, they have the agency in a way to determine how many people actually cross the border, because, you know, the security forces in the Bangladesh side can take money and the Indian side can take money, and they can, let people in or let people go to the other side, or, you know, into India or out of India. Of course, you know, that's definitely an issue. And wherever you have a regime that is based on the sort of, you know, idea of control, you definitely have corruption there. And, you know, and there are certain points. The major thing that people also talk about in Tripura is trading. There are certain points at the border where people come and trade from both the sides. But these are only regulated points. What about these sort of, non-regulated or unregulated sort of points all across the hundreds of miles long borders all around? And people, that's the thing. Like I said, there's a village in between the fence and the small pillar, which you call the actual line of control or whatever it is. And they say they do not want to move across to the Indian side because they find it easier for their, you know, to visit the relatives. I think that's quite a telling story of how people, value their movement and how a restriction on these movements can be very, you know, unpleasant to people.
So I'm just wondering if this fence is going to be used if and when the sea levels start to rise or there's a major storm and a lot of Bangladesh is, I mean, they're saying that a lot of people are going to be refugees in that area, and that these fences, you know, they're going to be, as the borders between Western Europe and, you know, Africa, and these people are waves of people bashing against Fortress Europe every day. You know, you'd read reports from off Italy, you know, boatloads of people, and then is it going to be the same over there? So it seems like the No Border movement's really building up at the moment again. There's about 3 No Border camps planned across different parts of Europe this summer. because we can't all take this lying down, really. And so, yeah, this Saturday on the 30th of June, there's an organising meeting, public meeting, to get involved in planning the September 2007 camp against a new detention centre and migration controls being brought in at Gatwick Airport. And we already have Harmansworth near Heathrow, so they're planning to implement some more of these camps to just lock people into. They don't like them moving around. And so if you want to get involved in preventing them from building that, Saturday 13th of June, 1 till 6 p.m, that's at the Rampart Social Centre, 15 Rampart Street, Whitechapel, E1. And you can find out much more information at www.noborders.org.uk. Oh, that camp is probably going to be the 19th to 24th of September, and it's going to be somewhere near Gatwick.
Somewhere near Gatwick, so take your earplugs, because aeroplanes are loud, as anyone knows that lives underneath a flight path. Well, now we're going to be hearing from Gaza. We're going to be hearing from a female correspondent called Mona, who lives in Gaza. But I've just realised Zoe has more announcements for me. Before we go to Gaza, we've got more announcements about here. So, let's go.
There's so much happening this weekend. You know, it's summer and everything's cooking up.
All right,
up.
There's a lot happening this weekend, and it's summer and everything's cooking up.
Go on, it is. Well, because also in September, it's the good
That's
old...
autumn.
Yeah, but you've got to plan over the summer. So some of us, on 11th of September 2001, were demonstrating outside the Defence Systems and Equipment International exhibition, which is the world's largest arm fair, and it takes place every 2 years in East London's Excel Centre. That's down sort of past Docklands. It's a crazy thing. Massive local opposition, huge bill to the
children
taxpayers.
Are imprisoned in schools.
Children, yeah, the local children are deeply opposed to this, and the police won't even let them come near to see and speak about what they feel about this. So, yeah, if you're against the arms trade, if you're against war, stopping people buying and selling weaponry with UK taxpayer support is kind of the start, where you would start to get in the way of this whole process. So, also this Saturday, from 2 till 4, so you could go on later to the No Borders meeting. Anyway, 2 till 4 in room 2C at the University of London Union on Mallet Street, WC1E. So that's a Disarm Dicey. Dicey is how they pronounce DSEI, which is the Defence Systems Equipment International. So get along there to stop the arms fair.
And just one word of warning. The Forward Intelligence team tends to film people that go to these meetings, so it's hoods up if you don't feel like being on files.
And if you're not in London, if you're up north, we have two major public events on social justice to mark 200 years since the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade and the launch of a new master's degree in activism and social change. You need a master's in all this. It's the only way. Come on, no, you don't. But if you do want a master's, you can now go to Leeds University's Geography Department, where you can learn all about how to change the world.
Or you can get out on the street and learn practically.
But this is being taught by people who have done that, so you can share experiences and so forth. And the launch is going to involve Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who's an amazing Kenyan writer, a distinguished professor of English and comparative literature, director of the International Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he's a major figure, and he's going to be launching this, along with good old George Monbiot, British journalist and campaigner. So that's on Friday, 29th of June, 6 p.m, the Rupert Beckett Theatre, and all day Saturday as well. In Leeds. Now, if you're still in London, which, you know, good place to still be, the next weekend it's Africa at 50. It's a whole day of stuff, 2 days in fact, at the School of Oriental and African Studies on Friday the 6th and Saturday the 7th of July. And it's all about post-independence Africa. And there'll be rallies, students, young Africans, all talking about solving Africa's problems by Africans. So get along there if you want to know what Africans think about what's to be done in Africa, instead of listening to Bono and Geldof and Blair and Brown and all these other people. So that's at SOAS, and it's the 6th and 7th of July. The SOAS is the School of Oriental African Studies in Russell Square.
Okay, well, we're going to say thank you to Kazu for coming and talking to us from his mission. And thanks for Zoe for gathering up all the announcements. Thanks to the International Middle East Media Centre for supplying the world every week with a report from Palestine. And now we're going to go to Mona's report from Gaza. Thank you.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Now 40 years and counting, Israel's occupation and Gaza's suffocation, with Dr. Mona El-Farah.
Dr. El-Farah is a physician, a human rights activist, and mother in the occupied Gaza Strip. She's the director of Gaza Projects for the Middle East Children's Alliance. Dr. El-Farah is also the vice president of the Palestinian Red Crescent Society of the Gaza Strip and a member of the Union of Healthcare Worker Committees. Now she will speak to us about life in Gaza and Palestinian rights, and it is indeed a pleasure to have you with us.
Hello, thank you.
Well, there's not a day now that we have woken up without hearing that there have been more lives lost in Gaza, and I can't help but say that I feel that Gaza is being suffocated. Dr. El-Farah, how do you look at the situation? How are we to understand what has transpired in Gaza?
The situation looks very gloomy, actually, in Gaza. And it is not only 40 years of occupation. It is 59 years of brutal occupation since Israel was founded on the ruins of the Palestinian in the big, largest ethnic cleansing operation that subjected Palestinians who made refugees after that year. Let us go back to the situation in Gaza. Gaza is a very small place, very, very small place, tiny place, and yet it is a big prison for its 1.4 million of population. Half of them are children, and there is great restriction of movement in and outside Gaza. So it is really like a big prison. Yet in that prison there is economical sanctions now and embargo about embargo because of the against the government in Gaza Strip. So, and this affects the normal population. Poverty levels have increased to unprecedented levels. Now you can talk about 70% of the population completely rely on international aid. And this affects the health of the children and affects the population in general. When I talk about the health of the children, our indicators is many children, more than 42% of the children of Gaza Strip under the age of 5, suffer from iron deficiency anemia, and this is due to lack of balanced food. More than or around 30% of the children of Gaza Strip suffer of of severe symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Patients in Gaza Strip are dying daily because they cannot cross the borders for further treatment outside Gaza. Usually the health facilities in Gaza give you primary and secondary health care, which is, despite of this, it is inadequate. But some patients, many patients, need to be referred for further treatment, and I'll give an example of cancer patients dying daily because they are delayed and denied their permit to leave Gaza for further treatment outside. So the situation on a humanitarian level is very deteriorating. There is a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, but it is not only humanitarian. A humanitarian is one side of what's going on. There is another side which is political. The Palestinian people is after or are looking to achieve their inalienable rights, and this cannot be achieved while the occupation is there. The occupation is there in Gaza, despite of the fact that the whole world has seen the settlers leaving Gaza Strip almost 2 years ago now. The Israeli settlers, the cameras showed the settlers leaving Gaza, but no, the settlers left Gaza, but the occupation still controlling our lives. They control our borders, they control our economy, they control our movement. So we are still under occupation, but different sort of occupation. This is how the picture looks like in Gaza these days. And of course, many of you must have heard that there are interclasses, factional interclasses inside the Gaza Strip. This was expected because of the very uptight situation and boiling situation inside Gaza Strip.
The United States tries, I think, to portray itself as a arbiter or as a neutral third party trying to help find a solution to the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. What do the American people need to know about the role of the U.S.?
The American people need to know that without the full political, military, economical support for the Israeli occupation wouldn't continue. It has continued for 40 years because of the American government support. And the American government support is using the tax money of the ordinary American people, tax money that should have been used for jobs, for education, for health inside the United States. Is using to give Israel the right to control other nation, which is Israel. So this is very important for the American people to know that with their tax money, other nations are attacked.
Dr. Elfra, the media simile here portrays, which you've dealt with somewhat, the tensions that exist amongst the residents of the Gaza Strip as internecine activity of a civil war nature. Flesh out for us more what are the conditions and situations that certainly have result on the loss of Palestinian life.
You mean the Palestinian interclashes?
Yes.
Yeah, there are at the moment Palestinian interclashes. It is mainly between the major two polar powers inside Gaza Strip, Hamas and Fatah. And again, this is, of course, I'm not proud of this. I'm not satisfied. I don't give any excuse for the Palestinian people to fight each other. But despite of this fact, I know very well that the underlying cause is the occupation. The occupation made the road very paved for this interclasses to happen. And actually, there are when we are talking about Hamas or Fatah, Fatah is very supported, or the stream in Fatah that's fighting against Hamas is very supported by the USA. Again, the USA, instead of finding solutions for resolving the problem, they are supporting one faction against the other. So they have, again, another role in making these interclasses flourish. And again, I say, I don't find excuses for my people to do this, but when you analyze the underlying causes, here is the case, the occupation, the intervention or interference of the USA in the internal policy of other people, like what's happening in Gaza Strip.
You are the director of the Rachel Corrie Children's Center in Gaza. Could you tell us more about that center and how it's supported?
Actually, I am the founder of the center and many centers like that in Gaza Strip. And the Rachel Corrie Center in Rafah, in the south of Gaza Strip, it is a place for the children from the age of 6 till age of 16, a place where they can find a heaven for them to come and play and paint, read, dance, do different activities, summer activities, indoor activities, outdoor activities. We are trying in that center to make a place where the children gather in the memory of Rachel Corrie, that have lost her life as an outcome of being in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
And that was a report from Building Bridges with the director of the Rachel Corrie Center. Now coming up, we have the Hour of the Apocalypse, and I'm going to play out on a song called Salam, which is a collaboration between Welsh musicians and Palestinian musicians. The Hour of the Apocalypse is going to be bringing you today Arcana, and that's our engineer there, gathering up the leads. Good night. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Resonance FM.